I'll start today's lecture and time with you by asking you, what do you think of when you hear the word environmentalism? In other words, that brings or should bring to mind a whole set of concerns that are often in the news and perhaps have been in discussion among you. I'm going to jump ahead here to item number two, the issues that are related to environmentalism. Let's just throw some up on the board, and then we're going to come back to them, Lord willing, by the end of the class. Shout out some issues that go under that umbrella. Global warming is one. All right. Not infrequently. Warming is what I think I meant to say. Not infrequently in the news. Global warming, what else?
Littering.
All right, so let's put that under the big umbrella. So littering the planet, what would be a big word for that?
Trash.
Trashing the planet, okay. How about when it's going into the air?
Pollution.
Okay, so can we put it all under the heading of pollution? We're polluting the ground, we're polluting the water, we're polluting the air. Pollution is a big environmental issue. Sir?
Deforestation.
Excellent. All right. What does that big word mean? Did I spell that right? Oh, well. Is it? Yeah. What's deforestation?
Cutting down too many trees and not keeping up with the amount of trees that there should be.
All right. Why is that a big deal?
Trees to breathe.
We need trees to breathe. Okay, that makes it a big deal. All right, what else?
Animals being pushed out of their habitats.
Okay. So there's two things that are going on there. Some would call that species reduction. So there's the concern that we're actually losing certain creatures or kinds of creatures because of the activity of man. And then I thought you might be referring to something else that's related. It's in this ballpark of environmentalism, though maybe not entirely. It also involved animals. Some people talk about animal rights. Those are connected. But whether we want to use that term or not, people are referring to cruelty and preventing certain kinds of behavior that's cruel to animals. Yes. Oh, was that not a hand? What other issues? Broad umbrella. Yes. Sorry.
I don't know whether it be urban or human encroachment, but with the growth of the cities.
Okay. All right. So the concern that one thing that comes up under that. Onto that subject you just raised is the question of population or overpopulation, because there's a concern that as humans multiply, they can go beyond the ability of the earth to sustain them or for other living things to be sustained along with them. So we'll put so-called overpopulation. I'm trying to make judgments just yet. These are just issues that arise. Sustainable farming is a big thing right now. And that's a concern to rethink some of the ways in which mass-scale farming has taken place, particularly in developed countries. That hasn't had due regard for the land and for the long-term use of the land. Renewable energy is another. David, did I just steal your thunder? Oh, sorry. Howard, what were you going to call it?
I was just going to say we're using up our sources of energy pretty fast.
Okay.
We need to find the right way.
Renewable energy is a big issue. What was the one I just said before that?
Farming
Sustainable farming, yeah. When your writing is that bad, it actually raises the question, why would you even put it on the board? But I don't know. All right. So, guys, when I introduced to you the subject of environmentalism, or I'm calling it environmental stewardship because we're returning to an ethics class unpacking the Eighth Commandment, that's the big grab bag of issues that you'll hear a great deal about in our society. Why is this something that is appropriate to talk about under the heading the Eighth Commandment? If you move your hand, I'll consider it a volunteer to answer. Yes?
Because the Eighth Commandment is trying to promote good stewardship of the gifts that God's given you, not taking others, and either is a very large gift of the population and then giving stewardship over.
You guys, you think that's good? You think he's right? Environmental stewardship should be a Christian concern in as much, as Tristan was saying, the planet has been given to us as the image bearers within it, humankind, in order to be a good steward of. And so, it is, another way of saying this is, if we do not care well for the planet, in the most broad sense, we are not being good stewards of what God has given us. I think that's just elementary. That shouldn't even be debatable. I don't actually think that many Christians would debate that, but you do need to know that environmentalism, as an ism, and much of the discussion surrounding it is very debatable. And it's very debatable among Christians. Why in the world would it be debatable that Christians should have should be good stewards of, or that mankind should be good stewards of the planet? Well, it becomes a debatable issue. I'll simply say, because I think there are extreme views on both sides. And as I go forward this morning, I'm going to be keeping in mind extreme views on both sides. There is something called environmentalism that can reach a pretty extreme form. And in its extreme forms, the environmental movement and environmentalism can become something antithetical to Christianity. We're going to be talking about that. Especially when environmentalism is joined to the worldview of naturalism. And naturalism as a worldview is simply the view that there is no supernatural, there is no deity, there is no spirit world. What we can see and touch, what is of the natural order, is all that is. And very often in the secular realm, environmentalism is joined with a pretty radical variation on naturalism. You've heard the expression Mother Earth. You could put a positive spin on that, but it'd be a stretch. There can come to enter into environmentalist zeal in our day, a kind of religious zeal. In the place of God, the cosmos has come to be for many, so that the all-consuming devotion of extreme, in many cases radical environmentalists, is devotion to the cosmos, this magnificent entity, the natural order and its well-being, that becomes its own form of idolatry. We'll be coming back to that as we go forward, and it's particularly going to be obvious to us that that particular radical form of environmentalism comes to have a very low, there's no view of God, And so there's a very low view of man. Man is no longer, in that view, an image of God and with a particular, a unique value in nature. So that's an extreme on one side, maybe, yeah, as you're facing me, on the left. There's also an extreme on the other side. I think there's an extreme reaction. Oftentimes it's a reaction to radical environmentalism, and it's an extreme that can be found outside the church and inside the church. And that extreme reaction to environmentalism is, as I'll be unpacking it, this refusal to consider that in fact the natural order, the creation, is something that God values and has entrusted to us in order to use well and for His glory. And I'll be pointing out that sometimes it's our eschatology as Christians that serves us poorly in this area. I think that, if I could put it this way, there's a way of thinking among some Christians in their extreme reaction to extreme environmentalism. Hey, what's the big deal about polluting the planet, about using up all the resources of the planet, about depleting all the, excluding certain species? What's the big deal? It's all going to burn anyway. You can hear in that a Christian, particular Christian view of the end of this planet that begins to think of the planet more like a disposable cup. You go to Chick-fil-A and they give you a cup, and if you still have that cup 5 years later, I'm kind of concerned about you. Those cups are supposed to be just used and thrown away. And I'm going to be saying to you that there's a view, sad to say, there's a view among some Christians that this planet is nothing more than the napkins that you use for a few minutes after a meal, and then you throw them away. There's absolutely no concern for the whole subject we're taking up today. So what I want to do is recognizing that these issues that come up under this broad heading of environmentalism involves a tremendous amount of, in some cases, scientific evaluations and analysis, and other times just data that I frankly don't have access to. I'm not an authority on each of these issues. What I want to do primarily is spend time looking at five biblical principles that should guide us in thinking about this subject. And if I can persuade you of these five biblical, or root more deeply in your souls, these five biblical principles, then I am confident that you will be able to navigate the discussions with increasing wisdom in the course of your days confronted with this issue of environmental stewardship. So, number one, and you'll need your Bibles. Number one, most basically, the God who created the world loves the world. And so should we. Elementary, my dear Watson. The God who created the fish in the sea and the birds in the air and the trees on the mountains and the rivers and the lakes and the seas and all the different bugs and creatures and all the tremendous diversity of planet Earth, and for that matter, the cosmos beyond it. He made it. And guys, this can be something we just forget about. He made it to be personally delightful to Him. Before mankind even showed up, He was delighting in what He had made. Why are things so delightful in this world? I drove in the driveway of the church today and saw the pear trees blooming there in the front, and it's just delightful all over again. It's beautiful. Why does that exist? It's not chiefly because you and I think it's beautiful. It's because The Creator thinks it's beautiful. I want you to remember, and you can turn now to Psalm 104 as one of the greatest songs about God as a nature lover. Okay, you know that expression, nature lover. Some people are nature lovers, some people aren't. Which is to say, some people like to get out. They like to go into the woods or up in the mountains or what have you. They even sometimes like to sleep outdoors. And there are other people who say, yeah, have at it. That's just not for me. I'm sure we're divided, maybe even pretty evenly in this room, between so-called nature lovers and those who say, yeah, just give me the air conditioning. I'm not talking about that level. I'm talking about something far more profound. God, who made the natural world, loves it. Psalm 104 is the sometimes called the creation psalm. And I am going to read a portion of this just so you get the sense. I want you to think of God depicted here as the one who plants, like one of us who plants a garden and then sees everything growing in it and is just delighted to be among the things that he's planted. Let's begin at verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. You see why this would be called the creation song. He lays the beams of his chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundation so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. This is a passage that's appealed to refer to creation science and flood research. It's interesting. Verse 6, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. I read this. The waters stood above the mountains. Verse 7, at your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so they may not again cover the earth. Now that much is a sort of poetic description of the creation week, I believe. I think that's what it's referring to. The waters and the land being separated, remember that? So that far is about creation. Now as the psalm continues, listen as it describes God. Did any of you have gardeners in your family? I mean, like a parent or two that really, yeah, really, Cleveland here, really just love to see things grow under their hands in their gardens, to beautify things, to just be there and to enjoy it. This is the way God is depicted. Verse 10, you make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. This is not talking about creation now. This is about providence. God's ongoing care, loving care for the natural world. So the rain that just fell in Charlotte this past day or two, that's God with his watering can in his garden. That's the poetic language of Psalm 104. Verse 14, you cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine and bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. Wait a minute. He planted them? Well, it's not overlooking that, you know, trees grow because of that whole cycle of seeds that fall and then are germinate and then grow. And so, but it's saying God is the one intimately involved in all of his creation, making these things happen. Next time you see a tree beginning to grow out of the ground, think, well, I wonder when God planted that. This is the picture of God in the natural world, delighting in cultivating what he's made. The psalmist is depicting God as a great nature lover. And the reason this is where I'm starting is that we want to be like God. Whether or not you want to sleep out there with the bugs or not, that's not really an issue of holiness. But you and I are to have the same view of nature that God does, which is to be thoroughly delighted by it and protective of it and zealous to, in imitation of God, to cultivate it. I could look with you at other passages. Psalm 104 is my favorite. I just want to remind you that John 3:16, which is probably the most famous verse in all the Bible, refers to God loving the cosmos. That's the word world in John 3:16. At Resurrection, we just heard a great sermon from our intern on this. God so loved the world. That is to say, everything that he had made. He loved the cosmos. That's the word in the Greek there for world in John 3:16. He loved the world. He's wanting to preserve what he's made in all of its grandeur. So he did what had to be done in order to bring salvation. He sent his son. Jesus talks this way about God as a nature lover in Luke 12. And we won't turn there, but that's where he's talking about our ability not to worry. Because the God who clothes the lilies, he gives them their clothes, will also give you your clothes. The God who feeds the birds will also give you your food. And you could say, Jesus, that's pretty fanciful. I know how the birds get their food. They go out there and do their bird thing in the yard. And they find their food. But Jesus is saying, no, absolutely every creature that is sustained by every worm or seed, in the case of birds, is so sustained because God is delighting in what he's made. Do you see how this should be formative for this whole subject that we have on the environment, so-called? If God made the environment, if he made nature, if he made the creation in order for his own enjoyment, first and foremost, then it's an act of faithful stewardship to him that we tend and care for what he's made in a way that's consistent with his enjoying of it. Do you think that he is delighted by rivers that become so toxic in the pollution that's dumped into them that fish can no longer live? No. And so at a most basic level, the environmental concern, which is good stewardship of what has been made, is a Christian concern because God is a nature lover. Second principle. And as I move on, I hope you're going to see that now we're going to be pushing back a little bit on some of the environmental extremism in our society. Number two. Man, human beings, if you prefer, are the pinnacle of all God's creatures. And all other creatures exist for them. This is the crystal clear biblical teaching that God has given a special role for mankind within his creation. And that role is not only to be a good steward of everything he's made, but also to make use of what else there is in creation for his own good. So this is something that in its extreme forms environmentalists can lose sight of. God has ordained that the world, both plants and animals, for example, be used for the well-being of his image bearers. So we see that in Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 9. In Genesis chapter 1, he says very clearly, Verse 29, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. This isn't highly debatable, even in the extreme versions of environmentalism. I don't know of anybody who seriously argues that plants have got a right to live too, and we shouldn't kill them in order to eat. Genesis 1 makes very clear that God ordained that the plant world exist for the good of human beings. But Genesis 9, you might want to look at that one. Genesis chapter 9 makes very clear that creatures, animals, also exist for the sake of men. Verse 3 of Genesis 9, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Do you see a pretty clear elevating of the life of man in terms of its importance in God's eyes over the life of animals? So much so that God explicitly says that animal life rightly serves human life, even to the point of food. This is part of what is meant when God says to Adam and Eve, I want you to take dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. This principle of mankind having dominion over the creatures is something that's frequently missed in radical environmentalism. What do you think of when you think of human history and you think of man having dominion of the creatures? What comes to your mind? What are some examples of that? You're thinking of the westerns that we still enjoy. Well, maybe you weren't thinking of that specifically, but you're exactly right. I mean, how much of human history, transportation involved either boats or horses? It's just, yeah, I mean, and both are forms of dominion. When humans devise a way to tame a horse and all the power, the strength of a horse, and make that horse subservient to the needs of a family to move about, for example, or to plow a field or what have you. That's taking dominion over the creatures. There's a different kind of taking dominion that's happening when you sail a ship. How's that taking dominion?
I don't know what the best word to say. You control the water, but you're like able to use the strength of just the raw power of the ocean to get you to your destination.
You're exactly right. So some guy or girl, I don't know, first figured out, wait a minute, there's actually a way that you can be in a boat on the sea with the wind coming towards you and you can actually sail into the wind by tacking. I don't know much about sailing, but I know that is amazing. You can actually, with the hoisting of a sail and operating it correctly, you can actually move. I think it has to be in a zigzag fashion. You can move in the very direction the wind is blowing. Who thought that up? That's taking dominion over the forces of wind. These are examples, though, of God giving to mankind the responsibility of stewardship and also the privilege of using it for his own well-being. This runs in the face of some of the more extreme versions of animal rights activism, for example. Have you ever heard the term biological egalitarianism? I hope you haven't, because you would be a real nerd if you did. But biological egalitarianism is the view that all life is equal. And there is no greater claim to the resources of the planet for humans than there is for groundhogs. They have the same rights, the same claims, and never can the needs of humans be elevated over the needs of other living creatures. That's biological egalitarianism, and it's directly contrary to what the scripture lays out in Genesis 1 and 9.
So, do these people just not eat? Like, if everything has the same rights as them, then how can they choose?
Well, they're usually vegans. Though I'm not saying that all vegans have this radical view. There's all kind of reasons to be vegetarians and vegans, and some of them are just purely medical. They're not philosophical. But they typically don't view animal life as equal. But they do tend to see that any creature has the same, which is why we get into interesting discussions, thanks to the environmental movement today, about whether the survival of the snail darter, I don't even know what that is, but it was quite a celebrated thing even in our area at some point, is more important than building a church or a hospital or a school or a housing development. And there are hard questions that arise. A Christian ought to say, we don't want to by our irresponsibility, end up with fewer species of those things that God has created for his delight. We want to be preserving what he's made. At the same time, the other consideration is we also know that he's made all things for us as his image bearers. Are you raising your hand? Okay, I couldn't tell.
I have a really good example.
Okay.
Like, my church wasn't allowed to, like, expand more on the land that it's currently on because there's, like, an extinct mussel there.
A mussel.
And the government wouldn't let them expand on the mussels, so they're trying to build somewhere else.
All right. So you see the clash between a certain creature and the needs or wants, however we put it, of human beings. That's a great example. Your church was facing that.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So what the Bible is very clear about, not every prudential judgment call on these things, but it's very clear that God has entrusted to man stewardship of other creatures and given to man those creatures for his good. This is a clear principle in the scripture. Biological egalitarianism is radically opposed to God's creation intentions. Number three, I'm kind of moving back and forth between these two radical extreme views in the area of the environment. Number three, God has called man to be a steward of his creation. And that involves bringing it to its full potential. Here I'm wanting to go back to that expression found in Genesis 1. God says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Okay, that involves having children. That involves raising children to be faithful stewards and worshipers of God. And then he has the second part of that mandate. And have dominion over the fish of the sea. And over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that lives in the earth. What is this dominion? To some people, it sounds like God's saying, I can do whatever I want because I've got the authority over the planet, over the creatures. Humans have the authority to do what they want with what God has made. What's wrong with that? What'd you say? Is it what's being missed about that notion of taking dominion? Who ultimately takes dominion over the planet? God. So he's telling Adam and Eve, I want you to do with the planet what I have been doing with the planet. He's the great dominion taker. So in the creation week, he was the one who spoke things into existence and then began moving things about. putting water here and mountains there, putting light here and putting dark there, putting birds into the air and fish into the sea. You see what he's doing? God is the one taking dominion, which is he has taken this big lump of something, which is what the planet starts with. The earth was formless and void, and the Spirit of God was hovering over it. Remember that part? He takes this big blob that he's brought into existence, and he begins to bring out from it beautiful things, useful things, wonderful things. He's bringing it to its greater potential, but he doesn't do all of the work. He actually just begins, it's the magnificent beginning, and then he says to Adam and Eve, you pick up where I left off. Think about it. He doesn't give Adam and Eve the ability to create out of nothing, obviously. But he puts Adam and Eve in a garden, and then he says, guess what your job is, Adam? Gardener. Which is to say, in a very preliminary way, I want you to continue to do, as my image bearer, what I began. I want you to make this place something to behold. And I think what's happening in Genesis is the whole earth is in a garden. God has given Adam a head start in the Garden of Eden, and he's intending for Adam and Eve and their children to eventually make the whole planet like the Garden of Eden. In other words, he wants them to cultivate what he's made. And taking dominion is a kind of rule over the planet that brings the planet, brings the natural order to its full expression, to its beautiful expression, to its most useful expression, so that we're sitting in this room with lighting that is exceedingly useful to us, especially if we were having this class at night. It would be indispensable to what we were doing. That's a form of taking dominion. Because somebody said, there's this flow of electrons thing that I think could really be put to good use. Kind of like horses can be put to good use. The flow of electrons can be put to good use. And somebody, actually a whole bunch of somebodies, was so ingenious that they then took this raw element in our natural world, this thing called electricity, and they've harnessed it. Now you can do 0 to 60 in an electric car that beats all internal combustion engines standing still. This is taking dominion in a way that's magnificent and glorious. But you see, it has within it, that concept of taking dominion has within it both the principle that we are, in fact, to put our hands on the planet and to do stuff with the planet. That's our calling. That's what God says to do. You're to put your hands on the planet and you're to do stuff. But you're supposed to do it in a way that conserves and preserves and beautifies and makes more useful, doesn't pollute and doesn't deplete and all the rest. So a Christian view of taking dominion has both of these elements. It rebukes those who are careless of the creation, and it rebukes those who want to act like the best thing for man to do would be to just go live in tents and no longer build anything. It rebukes both sides.
Okay, so as God, like, he stewards the earth, like, how did destroying, like, the world, like, setting a flood and making some animals extinct, how is that, like, a stewardship in God's part?
Oh, well, the flood. Well, this is going to come back up. The flood was God's cleansing of the earth, and it was a restart. And what's fascinating about the flood account is that it is intended by God as a picture of what's going to happen on the final day. Except what he does on the final day by fire, he did in the days of Noah by water. And notice, the flood is God's, it's a horrific display of God's displeasure at man for their sin and at the effects that that sin has had on the planet. And so, yes, God does wipe out all living things, but in order to, what, start over with a different kind of cosmos entirely? No. In order to cleanse what he's made and bring renewal, a restart. So it's interesting, the fact that the creatures outside of the ark, along with all of humanity, is perishing as a sign of God's wrath against sin, and all that which is within the ark is a sign that God loves not just people, but animals, the creatures that he's made. So both are there. We're going to come back to that when talking about the final day. I need to hurry because I'm running myself out of time. Have you ever been to a third world country? When you go to a third world country, you will some of the culture shock you'll experience when you realize, wow, there are just things that are missing here that I'm so familiar with in my culture. So much of the culture shock you experience is from the differing ways that cultures have taken dominion and the different degrees to which cultures have taken dominion. So, for example, we just had some gully washer rain in Charlotte. And, you know, it can slow us down and temporarily can make people kind of stay home because there's flash flood warnings and so on. But it's amazing how water, rainfall, even a dramatic amount of rainfall, can barely slow down a developed Western country, first world country, if you will, whereas this kind of rain brings things to an utter standstill, even for days, in other parts of the world. You know why? Because we have road systems that are paved. We have patios. We have sidewalks. We have automobiles that keep you dry. They have headlights. They have windshield wipers. And all these things are ways of taking the blessing of rain, receiving it, without being disabled by it. That's an act of man, a society taking dominion over the earth. And when you recognize that, I've been to Uganda as an example. The rainy season means you simply can't travel anymore. You are not going to get where you wanted to go if you're going from the south to the north, for example, in the rainy season. It's because there hasn't been yet the same degree of taking dominion that something as simple as pavement entails. Number four. Back and forth between two extremes that I keep envisioning in my mind on this subject, environmentalism. Number four, the Bible is very clear, wasting and polluting the environment is a form of theft. It's stealing. Now, how is that so? What do you think I mean by that? Who are you stealing from?
God.
Your children. All right. So if you have allowed for a level of pollution in your city or country that is going to ensure that there will not be any more fish or there will not be enough oxygen producing vegetation, what have you, for the generations to come, you're stealing from your children, from your grandchildren. But it's even more immediate than that. You said stealing from God. I think that's actually the most basic thing. You're taking from God. Everything that exists is His. You're taking from God the value of what... Remember we talked about vandalism? And if somebody comes to your car and steals it, that's an obvious violation of the Eighth Commandment. But if someone comes to your car and just sets it on fire, they haven't stolen it in the most obvious sense, but they have, haven't they? The vandalism they've done has deprived you of it. And ultimately, polluting and the like is depriving God, in a very real sense, from the delight he would otherwise have in that particular part of creation, it's also stealing from our community. When I'm sitting at a red light and somebody ahead of me in the car rolls their window down and flicks out their cigarette butt, they're in the median. Guys, I've actually had a few moments where it was all I could do to keep from getting out of the car and going up to that cigarette butt and flicking it back in his window. And if you read about me in the paper someday, been booked, my face is there, it's probably because I did that. That's why I went to jail and all the stuff that happened after I did that. Who is he stealing from when he contributes to the pile of cigarette butts that are right there at the stop sign or stoplight in the median? He's stealing from all the rest of us, because that's part of God's gift that we share. The community, the world in which we live, that particular part of the world in which we find ourselves placed, that's something we share together. The Bible has some clear teaching about the creation as groaning under the curse that God has brought upon man for his sin. Romans 8, verse 20. The creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The creation is affected by mankind's sin. When a coal company releases all their coal ash, whatever that is, inadvertently or otherwise, into a river, the Bible actually personifies creation as groaning at the effects of human irresponsibility. It's a form of vandalism, and it's right to think that carelessness on the part of big industry, carelessness with regard to that person sitting at the red light, is a violation of the Eighth Commandment, stealing from those around them who share the gift of clean air or clean water or what have you. Number five, biblical principle that should inform us in this whole subject is this: redemption, brothers and sisters, redemption will bring about the restoration of nature. And that should inform us in our view of stewarding the environment. Guys, I will tell you that this whole subject, for all of its complexity and all of its extreme on two sides, that became of greater interest to me when my eschatology got straight. My view of the end times. Not all the debatable stuff, not all the specifics, but some of the most basic things about what the Bible teaches about how the human history is going to end. Remember I said at the outset, there is the kind of Christian Bubba view of environmentalism. What's the big deal? It's all going to burn. And I think that's actually taking a certain teaching of the scripture. It's found in 1 Peter, or rather 2 Peter chapter 3. It's taking a certain teaching that there is going to be this consummation of all of human history, and the natural world is going to be subjected to a kind of fire. 2 Peter 3 verse 10 talks about it. And it's arguing from that God isn't committed to the natural world. He's not committed to creation. He's not particularly concerned to preserve it. He's just letting it all run down, and he's going to throw it away. It's going into the great cosmic trash can one day, and he's going to come up with a whole new cosmos. He's going to create a new cosmos. That's what I mean by eschatology. If you have the view that the natural world, the creation we live in, is eventually just going to the trash can, why wouldn't you trash it now? why wouldn't you be? At the very least, you'd be less concerned about the stewardship because you know it's just something that God himself is going to crumple up and throw away. Guys, I think this is bad eschatology. I think it's a bad view, a mistaken view of God's plans for planet Earth. 2 Peter 3 is talking about a kind of cosmic moment when he says the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. I just want to draw your attention to the fact that whatever fire, whatever burning is taking place in that picture of the final day, it's a kind of burning that exposes things. What do you think he's talking about? It's a kind of fire that reveals things. He says all the works that are done on the earth will be exposed in that fire. What is he talking about? It doesn't sound like, if you look at it carefully, it doesn't sound like he's talking about just incineration, a natural incineration of the cosmos. I think the clues here are that in that same passage, in the context, he is referred back in verse 6 of 2 Peter 3 to the world perishing in the days of Noah. Question. Did planet Earth get annihilated in the days of Noah? It didn't, did it? He's using this language of perishing to refer to something analogous to what happens in Noah's day. And I'm arguing to you now that the broader teaching of Scripture is that on the last day, God is going to do what he did in the days of Noah in a far more climactic way, in a far more definitive way. And what he did in Noah's day is not annihilate the planet. That's the annihilation view of planet Earth. There is such a thing, an annihilation view. I'm arguing against that. He cleansed the planet and restored the planet and renewed it in the days of Noah. And that's what the broader teaching of Scripture is about the last day that we await. I'm going to have a lecture with my ninth graders about this in just a little while. And I'm going to point to four things God is going to do with planet Earth on the last day. He's going to cleanse it. Psalm 1, Proverbs 2. Matthew 13, he's going to cleanse it, which is to say, he's going to come to the earth, and with some process we can only imagine, because it involves his omnipotent power, he's going to take out of the earth all that is evil and broken. He's going to cleanse the earth. He's going to reshape the earth, recreate the earth. Acts 3 talks about this, the restoration of all things. Romans 8 talks about the creation groaning in anticipation of that day. By the way, if you're a creation and you're eagerly anticipating your own annihilation, that doesn't make sense, does it? But the creation is anticipating, in Romans 8 language, the same thing we are. Our bodies, though dissolved in the ground, are going to be resurrected, restored. And the creation is going to have the same experience as a whole. This is a good outcome or good ending. I'm going to say to ninth graders, the planet's going to be cleansed. It's going to be recreated. It's going to be inherited by us. That's the teaching of passages like Psalm 37, multiple places in that psalm. Or Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, verse 5. The teaching, the emphasis of the Bible is the meek will inherit the earth. So guys, you should be mindful that as you live within planet Earth, this is all going to be yours one day. How do you drive the car that isn't just a rental, but is the car Daddy said is going to be yours soon? How do you drive that car? Well, you drive it like somebody already owns it, right? You drive it like somebody wants to take good care of it. That's the way the planet is. And here's the clincher for how we should recognize from our good eschatology our responsibility to the world. Guys, the earth is going to be inhabited. That's number four. By God himself. This earth, the one we're living in, after it's been cleansed, after it's been recreated, after it's been inherited by us, or as it's being inherited by us, it's also going to be inhabited by Jesus Christ. He's going to live in this earth with us. Revelation 21 speaks of the Jerusalem that comes down from heaven, the presence of God, the dwelling of God, coming to this earth. So all that eschatology, when I got that clear in my mind, it helped me recognize Christians need to speak to these issues where they see anti-Christian, ungodly notions, and there are plenty of them in this whole environmental discussion. There's an idolatry of nature. But guys, we as Christians can't say, oh, this isn't our issue. This one isn't ours. We don't care about this issue. We'll let the world sort this all out. We're not concerned about, we can't do that. We can't because of the Eighth Commandment and the principle behind it. So everything that God has given, he intends for us to use to his glory, to be a good steward of. Herman Bovink is one of my heroes, theologian from the Netherlands. And he has a saying that I think is relevant to this whole subject. Grace restores nature. What God does in salvation is aiming at bringing us back to a place where we are, as he created us, nature. Grace in you, in your own personal life, restores nature. That's why you're going to be raised from the dead one day. Your body is precious to God. He's going to restore your nature. And that's what he's doing in the world. That's what he intends to do on the last day. And that should inform us as we navigate all these exceedingly complicated issues. All right, my friends. Once again, I'm leaving you with just a few pointers for a lifetime of considering some weighty subjects. Next time, we're discussing our book. And after we have had a discussion on that, we'll be taking up the Ninth Commandment, because we're then in the final stretch. Hey, have a good weekend. Thank you.